Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. This was the music that was unleashed on an unsuspecting world 50 years ago this weekend. Yes, the Eurovision was on in Brighton, and ABBA, who weren't even well known in their own country apparently at the time, or indeed not well liked, if they were well known by many people, stormed and won with that song. Teresa O'Farrell, you vividly remember because you were just turned 11 years of age.
Yes, I was, Joe. Only a little child, and I remember it very well. And really, it was the song of the year because I'd learned all the lyrics and actually, you know, sang it in a concert once, but with no audience. But I had blasted it out, myself and my cousin. We were the two girls, Anna Freed or whatever their names were. And we could sing it. And there was no internet then where you could look up the words. So you either learnt it or not.
Mm-hmm. And you said you sang it at a concert where no one turned up. Did your reputation precede you? Or
No. We were just having fun. We were on our summer holidays, staying in our aunt's house, and we just made a little stage for ourselves of bales of hay, hopped up on them and blasted it out.
And it was about the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah, but we didn't.
Waterloo, I was defeated, you won the war.
Won the war, yeah.
All the analogies.
Promise to love you forevermore. And
do you know who represented Ireland that year in Brighton, 1974?
No, actually, no. And that's quite interesting because I would have always watched Eurovision. In fact, the first year I remember knowing it, but I would have only been seven, was when Dana was in, but we weren't allowed to stay up to watch it. And the children of my family were listening to it on the radio upstairs. And then when Dana won, we ran downstairs to see the end of it. So we could have actually stayed up anyway because we weren't asleep.
You weren't allowed to watch the Eurovision?
Well, we were only tiny, like we were seven, and you know, my mum had a lot of children, so she was probably dying to have us in bed.
But you remember Dana, Winnie, but you remember Waterloo. By the way, have you tried to get to the ABBA, because they're bigger and bigger and bigger, the ABBA hologram experience in London?
No, I haven't, Joe.
Well, if you are thinking of going, you better start saving, because for two people, You could spend, well, I was looking for tickets there earlier on, they ain't available. The only tickets available will cost you €500 for two people. Wow.
I'm not even sure if it's my thing. I actually did see a hologram show once in the Bord Gáis, and it was an Elvis thing, and you had an original band in the background and then a kind of a hologram of him. It was okay. I mean, it wasn't bad, but I wouldn't pay €500 for the experience.
And it's booked out, and it because it's a hologram, it can go on in perpetuity because they're not obviously there. Stay with us, Teresa, because the conductor for RTE, indeed for Ireland, in Brighton, and indeed for a number of other years as well, was the legendary Colman Pearce. Colman, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Good
Great.
To hear you.
Yeah, likewise. And just to, your name would be so well known. You were a conductor at the RTE Concert Orchestra for a number of years. You were the conductor for Ireland at the 71 Eurovision, the 72 Eurovision, the 73, 74.
Much as I love the Concert Orchestra, I was also principal of the symphony.
I was about to get to that. You became principal conductor for the RTE National Symphony Orchestra in 1981. You were principal guest conductor at the Bilbao Symphony Orchestra, isn't that correct?
That's right.
And then you were a principal conductor and music director of the Mississippi Symphony Orchestra.
That's right. And yes, you have all your facts right, Joe.
And you were made Freeman, not unfortunately, there is still time, not of Dublin, but a Freeman of the city of New Orleans.
That's right.
Which is extraordinary, prestigious.
Yeah, yeah. Good honour. Yeah.
So you were there in 74, Colman. You were.
I was.
The song was Cross My Heart, sung by the wonderful Tina. Tina Reynolds, exactly. Tina Tully, yeah. Different incarnations. What are your memories?
It was a very exciting occasion, particularly after 73, where RTE had a very checkered time because of commercial interests. The song that year in 73 was Do I Dream?
Okay.
And it was sung by Maxi. We came that time, I think it was 11th. And okay. Tina was flown in that year in case of problems. She learnt the song and was ready to go on. So Maxi did the singing eventually, and Tina yeah. then was granted the honour of representing Ireland in the next year in Brighton in 74.
Okay.
And, you know, when ABBA came along, a lot of, we had a good group representing Ireland. There was a nice backing trio, mm-hmm. including the late John Curran. And I remember John saying to me in a little break that the song that the Swedish group ABBA was singing was Just Where It's At, Man. John was very hip. Just Where It's At, Man, beginning with a chord of the sixth.
Okay.
When, you know, if you listen to it, it does begin with a chord of the sixth. So John thought this was extraordinary, as we all did. We loved it. We loved their performance, ABBA. And as you say, they had been little known. But, you know, because they won, the next year was put on in Stockholm. And I met them there, and they were sidelined. They, as you said, they weren't very well known, even or liked perhaps in Sweden. And that year, they didn't figure really in any good way. They spoke to me and they said, "We feel sort of out of things here."
That's fascinating.
It was a shame. Yeah.
And given what was ahead of them, Coleman, they were
a wonderful career. Yeah,
still going. I know they. Yeah, they parted ways, but they came together for the opening and for the you haven't seen the ABBA hologram experience. Would that be your?
I haven't seen that. I heard you talking about it. It sounds very interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. €500 for two tickets.
Right. I'd want the real presence there.
As I say, it'll go on in perpetuity. On the night, was it obvious that they were going to walk away with it?
Yeah, those of us who liked it so much, we did think that would be the case. And I think they won quite comfortably. I think Italy came second. But, you know, as somebody said in the business, who remembers people who get second?
Exactly.
The people who get first that they remember.
Exactly. And apparently there's some story we'll get to it later on. There was some story that night, Coleman, about the Portuguese entry and a coup d'etat, so to speak, back in Portugal. But we'll hear about that in a few minutes. Do you still take an interest in it?
Well, sort of, but, you know, I think it's gone off the boil, really. And the emphasis when it began was on the quality of the songs, and that changed gradually. And nowadays it's the spectacle that apparently is important, so the quality of the music has gone right down, I think.
Okay, well, this...
You know, when you think that wonderful singers in the past, like Vicky Leandros, the Greek singer, she won for Luxembourg, Celine Dion, our own Johnny, who won it twice, but also penned at least one of the winning songs. Johnny Logan was terrific. Yeah. Tina was excellent representative. And the two other Irish girls, Linda Martin and Eve Kavanagh, they all had good songs, but the quality of the songs has disimproved. And indeed, there's some very tawdry stuff going on nowadays when I briefly glance at it.
Okay, well, I'll let you listen to our entry this year. Bambi Tog, and they are singing this piece. I thought I could never I speak to destroy the feelings I have. I cannot avoid through twisted tongues a hex deployed on you. That all the pretties in your bed escape your hands and make you sad, and all the things you wish you had you lose. I'm Coleman, would you be surprised to hear it's called Doomsday Blues?
I would be surprised to hear of any title it was given. I wish them well, but it's not my cup of tea, shall I say.
Well, what do you think of it as a piece of music?
Not much. Okay. And I don't want to offend the writers of it, but you know, where has the craft of songwriting gone when one hears a lot of stuff that's nowadays put out on Eurovision? Yeah, there are some great things came out of Eurovision, yeah, but not so much in recent years, I think. Anyway, good luck, Ireland. I think when Tom McGraw, the TV producer, was heading the whole thing, it was done in a very professional manner. Songs were selected professionally. The singers were nominated. That used to be the winning singer, winning song in the national, went on to represent Ireland. And all of that sort of changed some years ago with results that are palpably not as good.
But it is more spectacle now, isn't it?
It's a spectacle,
it's a TV.
Yeah.
And when you were, and you worked on it for a number of years.
Beginning in 71 in the Gaiety, because Dana had won in 70. We were the hosts in 71, and I did that year and the next year. I think it was Edinburgh and then Luxembourg and then Brighton. And then I asked Tom McGraw to make 75 my final year. That was Stockholm.
Okay.
I'd grown tired of what I consider the sort of tawdry commercial aspect of a lot of that business.
What do you mean by that, Colman? Because you mentioned it earlier.
Well, RTE had a very shoddy experience in 73 with the ugly head of commercialism rearing its head. We had a perfectly good arrangement of the song by the late, great Johnny Tate.
Yeah, Johnny.
And commercial interests wanted us to change that because it had been recorded with a different arrangement. RTE stood firm. I didn't like the whole goings-on at that time.
Okay.
And it sort of put me off the scene. I saw the way records were manipulated, and you know there was a lot of what I would call skullduggery. So there you go. Okay.
And people, Colman, for younger people especially, who've seen the Eurovision in the last say 15 years, spectacle of it. They, and if they know the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin, which a lot of people do, it's still standing, exact same configuration. They would find it hard to believe you could squeeze a Eurovision sound contest into the Gaiety. How did they squeeze the orchestra in, the concert orchestra in?
Well, the Gaiety has a pit, so that's where the orchestra was. So that was fine. You know, the stage was fully used for the presentation, and the orchestra in the pit was, I suppose, about 50 piece. It was good size.
Okay.
So no problems. But I take your point. I mean, nowadays it is a spectacle, and the Gaiety couldn't do it in real terms. But with tricky technical stuff nowadays, who knows, with green walls and what have you.
What was your favourite Eurovision entry? Is that an awkward question? Probably is.
Well, I did like Waterloo very much, and I loved Vicky Leandros singing Après Toi, which won, in Luxembourg in 72. She represented Luxembourg at least once, and of course Celine Dion represented Luxembourg another time. I think Luxembourg, I could be wrong on this, but they won 2 years in a row, you know, with non-Luxembourgese singers. But 2 years in a row was only equaled by Ireland, which has won 3 years in succession.
And 7 years overall, but not in recent years.
Seven overall, not in recent years.
Would you still, believe we should send an entry?
I think the process of selection and the guidelines perhaps need revision if we want to get back into winning again. And let's concentrate on the quality of the songs and, of course, the quality of the singing, because we had excellent singers singing good songs in the past. Let's get back to that.
Yeah, and as you say, we won it seven times.
Yeah,
which
amazing.
Is incredible.
Eurovision is actually Mr. Johnny Logan, you know, with his record of winning it twice and penning some winning songs.
For Linda Martin.
Representation.
Astonishing, astonishing. And then River Dance came out of Eurovision. That's still going strong.
Yeah.
And that will go on for many, many, many years.
That was one of the best intermission interludes ever.
Wasn't
amazing.
It?
beautifully done. Yeah,
beautifully done, beautifully done. And how are you now, Coleman? You sound fantastic. Why not? Why not? Says much. You.
I'm fine. I gave up the conducting part of my life in 2015. So I've had, as a friend of mine used to say about his own profession, I'm a recovering conductor.
Okay.
But I'm concentrating on composing since then. I always did some, but I never had much time as a busy conductor. But now I can do it.
And how are you finding composing now that you have more time?
Well, I love it. And I was honored to be taken into that artistic group called Es Dona.
Oh, magic. Oh, congratulations.
250 members. Yeah, 250 members maximum. Yeah, well, I'm delighted to be there.
That's and as you know, unless it's been changed, but the only way you can get the maximum 250, the only way they can bring in new people is if, God forbid, somebody dies.
You're exactly right, yeah. There's a whole rethinking about this. You know, the population of Ireland has risen a lot since Es Dona was founded.
Yeah.
And 250 is not representative anymore of the number of splendid artists out there. So the figure should go up.
And would that be, of all the honours you've received, Coleman, guy included, it sounds like Es Dona is up there.
It is, absolutely, because first of all, it's Irish. It's my native country. Yeah. Secondly, it's a position held for people who've distinguished themselves in the creative arts. So I'm in there on my laurels, if you like, as a composer. So that's very comforting, very nice.
And today, as you know, in the world we live in, there's the symphony orchestra, the concert orchestra. There was, as you know, a lot of discussion about the cost of running them and who should bear that cost.
RTE got out of the burden, so to speak, financial burden of the symphony a few years ago, and it's, I think, very well looked after now by the National Concert Hall, so that's good.
Yeah, okay.
And given the travails that RTE went through financially and so on in recent years, it's probably a good thing that they didn't have that extra cost to bear. And, of course, they're still supporting the concert orchestra, which is doing very good work.
But part of, as you well know, Colin, part of the argument in RTE was that they never felt fully appreciated for the worth, the incredible worth of the two orchestras, what they gave to the nation and what they did for music.
I think those of us who were in the profession and those of us, let's say, quote-unquote, who knew, we knew the value that to the country of what RTE was doing. It was a terrific financial burden and a terrific artistic thing to bear the cost of not only two orchestras, but a professional chamber choir and a string quartet based in Cork. You know, a lot of things went on. RTE has done Trojan work in that area.
And the Corn and Og and various other...
Yes.
And then the drama department. I remember, and you heard it as well, that when people used to, and we know it's a perennial, complain about the licence fee, very few people would ever mention, apart from in here, obviously, but you say to people, like, you know the argument, the television stations, the radio stations, and then the orchestras, and people say, the RTE, does my licence fee fund the orchestra? Yes, it does. It did for many decades, does for the concert.
That wasn't the fault of RTE. That was their own fault. Ignorance is bliss, but culpable ignorance is not to be rewarded. I think people should know that the function of the national broadcaster was including supporting two orchestras and a string quartet and everything else.
Hear, hear. Colman, great to hear your voice. You were I mentioned Es Dona, and the only way you can get into Es Dona is by a vacancy arising. You won't be by judging by your strong voice and energy, you will not be creating a vacancy in the next two or three decades, Colman Pearce.
Hopefully, Speramo.
You won't. And continued success with the composing and. The city of New Orleans gave you the freedom. I don't know, what does that allow you to do in New Orleans? Can you drive your flock of sheep down to the French Quarter?
I was allowed park with impunity.
Well, you know, a lot of people do that in Dublin, and they don't have the they don't have the freedom of the city. It's great to hear your voice.
Lovely to hear you too, Joe. Of course, I hear you more frequently than you hear me.
But I see the the text coming in saying it's just great, not just to hear your name again, but to hear your voice again, and such strong
voice.
Yeah,
good, I'm delighted.
Anyway, great, and continued good health to you and yours.
And the same to you, Joe.
Thank you so much, and continued creativity. That's the wonderful Colm and Pearce. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I mentioned this thing that was in the back of my head about the Portuguese entry in 1974 being some touch paper for a revolution in the country. Felipe Ribeiro de Menezes. Felipe, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Joe.
How are you? You're a professor of history.
That's right, in Maynooth.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And you're director of the MA in European History in Maynooth.
MA in European History, that's right.
Sounds absolutely fascinating. And a wonderful, wonderful third level college. Philippe, tell us about 50 years ago, the Eurovision Song Contest and the changing history of your country, your home country, Portugal.
Well, the entry for 1974 in Brighton, as you've been hearing, was called E Depois do Adeus, which means an after the goodbye. And it did very poorly. It came last with, I think, something like 3 points.
Yes.
Which was not unusual at the time. And in Portugal, people said, it's because of the regime. It's because of the dictatorship. Nobody wants to.
Of Salazar. Wasn't it Salazar?
Salazar had died by then, but his successor, a man called Marcel Caetan, was in power.
Okay.
And so the army decided to oust Caetan. In large measure because Portugal was still fighting a number of wars in Africa to keep its colonies there. And the army essentially had enough. And it realized that in order to end the war, they would have to overthrow the government. And this is what they resolved to do. So they had a coup planned.
Yeah.
And the way in which they were going to get certain messages out to the troops that were earmarked to participate in the coup was through the radio. And so there were two songs. One, E Depois do Adeus, the Eurovision entry, gave the signal the night before the coup that, okay, this is happening, so start mobilizing for it. And then there was another song called Grândola Vila Morena, which is a protest song. And that was the signal then to get on the road and head down to Lisbon and, you know, take over the airport and the radio stations and the government buildings, etc. So this you know, inoffensive ballad, which had won the Portuguese Eurovision contest, but had done so badly then in Brighton, was the signal to get the
so when
the coup was coming.
So that was played on the night of the 24th/25th.
That's right.
So they played the national radio station or whatever played the Eurovision entry that there, which did so badly, but they did play it, and that was a signal to prepare for the military takeover.
That was the confirmation that this is the night. So get ready to go.
Okay.
And when you hear the other song, which was played a few hours later, then you go.
Wow.
So it wasn't the national broadcaster. It was another broadcasting station. But obviously, you know, the DJ, I'm not sure if the DJ was in on it but obviously whoever was arranging the set lists for the songs was in on what was going on. Yeah.
It sounds like something from a broadcast that the Gaulle was making from London to France during the Second World War, wait for a Cold War or whatever. But
that's right.
So
yeah,
the Eurovision, it's incredible. The Eurovision entry, once it was played on this particular station, then the soldiers or the generals knew, well, we're get ready. And then when the second song was played, they knew it was
the signal to go out. Yeah.
It was game on and head to Lisbon and take down the government.
And take down the government, yeah. And I mean, obviously then the whole thing had been planned. So they, you know, the units knew which buildings to seize and everything else. But that's how it began. And it's an unusual way of going about things. I've never quite understood why that was the case. but it was a way of reaching all of the units which were scattered around the country at the same time. You know,
and
they could all hear it and know what it was.
And in 1974 was a different world in terms of communications and...
Absolutely,
you know,
absolutely.
50 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a way of making sure that everybody, you know, across the country who was involved in the coup could take the necessary steps, yes.
And the two songs again, Philippe, are the English titles of them were?
So the Eurovision entry was by a singer called Paul de Carvalho.
Okay.
And the song was called "E depois do Adeus," which means "an after the goodbye." So it's a kind of a
after the goodbye.
Woe is me, this love affair has ended. Where what am I to do myself?
So the first song was "After the Goodbye," and the second one was.
And the other one is called "Grândola Vila Morena," which so Grândola is the name of a town in southern Portugal. So it's sort of Grândola dusky town, something along those lines, and that was by a well-known protest singer, and it's a kind of a call for solidarity amongst everybody in the town and saying that this town is unique.
Okay.
So that town, that song being played on Portuguese radio at the time should have been a bit of a giveaway that something had gone wrong, you know. but certainly the first one was an absolutely innocuous ballad, the Eurovision entry, and it really didn't give anything away at all. It was quite a popular song in Portugal. I mean, I remember the melody still. And Eurovision was taken very seriously, especially the national contest. So for a song to have won the national contest was guaranteed hit for the year. However, it did in Europe. And usually, as I said, they were faring badly in the 1970s. But so it was a well-known song.
And why was it called that event, the revolution, Philippe? Why was it called the Carnation Revolution?
Because it was April and it's spring and carnations were in. You know, the flower sellers were full of carnations. So when, you know, there was no fighting, there was practically no fighting during the day that was in it.
Yeah.
So the troops are everywhere around the city. Slowly people begin to venture out and then in very large numbers and they distribute the flowers to the soldiers as a thank you for the action that they had taken. And so, you know, they decorate their uniforms, they decorate their rifles, and so the carnation becomes the symbol of the day, and it becomes the symbol of the revolution, as you say.
And the national anthem is not Carnation once again.
No.
As we'd say.
No, not at all.
But the day is still a national holiday, is it not?
It is. And so this year is the 50th anniversary. So it's not only the 50th anniversary of ABBA's victory, but it's the 50th anniversary of this Portuguese revolution, which was a very important event, not just for Portugal. As I said, you know, there were a number of colonies that Portugal was still holding on to in Africa and beyond, places like Timor and Macau. And so what the revolution in Portugal made possible as well then was that all of those colonies moved swiftly to independence.
Yeah.
But even next door in Spain, you still had General Franco in power, already very old. Be it in Spain, be it in Latin America, where you had all these other dictatorships in place, you know, the events in Portugal kickstart events elsewhere, and they make people realize, okay, you can have 48 years of dictatorship, you know, as was the case in Portugal, but it will come to an end. You know, they can't last forever.
But when people hear a military coup, they think it's a right-wing coup, but in this case, was it not more a left-wing coup?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a very unusual circumstance. But like I said, I mean, you know, the army had gone into the colonial wars that begin in the 1960s with a kind of a spirit of we will fight and give the politicians time to find a solution to this.
Okay.
And as the years passed and no such solution emerged, the military became more and more upset. And it was especially, I mean, it's usually referred to as the captain's movement or the captain's coup. So it was sort of middle-ranking officers, the captains and majors who had really had enough. And they're the ones who organized themselves. They established this armed forces movement, as it was known, and they plotted the coup, and they carried it out. They themselves, as time would then show, were, you know, not in complete agreement, shall we say, about what should follow. And so for the next year and a half, the situation in Portugal is actually quite confusing and difficult to follow until finally, parliamentary democracy emerges. But that there had been, you know, for 48 years of dictatorship, the country had been under a sort of a blanket repression with censorship and everything else. And so I think, you know, that year and a half of slightly chaotic politics was to be expected. Things couldn't just go overnight from one system to another.
Because the name Salazar was I know it was used in our parliament, as you may know, Philippe, when one politician was attacking another, and he compared the other politician to Salazar, and people demanded that he withdraw the comparison because such was the notoriety of Salazar.
But Salazar also had a great many fans in this country, especially back in the 1930s and 40s. The whole vocational
Catholic
movement,
the
idea of a kind of a Catholic brand of politics that would replace parliamentary democracy, and Salazar hadn't come to power through bloodshed, unlike, say, General Franco, who'd had to win the Spanish Civil War. So he was a professor as well, and so he was seen as a sort of the thinking man's, or, you know, the thinking Catholic's dictator, and he had quite a devoted following in this country. With time, that passed, as it did in most other places. But he had been very, very popular in Ireland for quite a long time.
Okay. I'm just wondering, what would the... God forbid we'd never have a military coup here, but we don't need one in the best sense of that word. But I just wonder, what two songs would the Irish Defence Forces pick to be the signal to move on government buildings? I presume...
I couldn't even begin to speculate on that, Joe.
I can say the one of the...
removed from my purview.
Well, maybe two of our Eurovision entries. What's another year? Or hold me now? Or maybe it'd be a one time.
Hold me now,
Philippe. Thank you so much. The course sounds fascinating in minute. It really does.
And, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And continued educational success. Thank you so much. That's Philippe Ribeiro de Menezes. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. He is a professor of history and director of the MA in European History in Maynooth. What a gift. What a gift. Go to Mila Margaret. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We're talking about the Eurovision Song Contest and the fact that tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of Waterloo winning the Eurovision Song Contest. Like you said before, in Brighton in the UK, and you hear Colman Pearce earlier, who conducted the Irish entry and has many other accolades or many other strings to his bow, if you pardon the mixed metaphors there. But he said at that time Waterloo was spotted by a lot of people as being a winner. But now Liam, am I pronouncing your name correctly, Liam, first of all?
Very close.
Okay, very close. Yeah, as close as I'll ever get, I suppose. Liam, tell us, what in the name of all that is Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, what you have written? Break it gently to our unsuspecting audience. What have you written?
I've written the entry for Latvia this year. It's called Hollow by an artist named Dons.
You've written the Latvian entry for the Eurovision.
Yes, and I produced it as well.
And tell us, how did you manage to get that accolade?
Yeah, it sounds weirder than it is. So basically, I am a full-time songwriter and producer, and I'd kind of travel around to like various songwriting camps and work with like different labels and artists, and you find yourself in kind of writing sessions with people that you've never met before. And on this particular day, I wrote a song in a camp in Spain, in Las Negras in Spain, beautiful part of the world. And that day I was in a session with the artist Dons. So we wrote this song without Eurovision really being an end goal. And he's signed to Universal, and they loved the song, and they really, really wanted him to represent Latvia in the Eurovision, and it just happened to be the right fit at the right time.
Okay, and what way did they, what process did they use to pick the song, Liam?
I honestly couldn't speculate because I wasn't involved in those conversations, but I just got an email saying we love this and we want to pursue it for Eurovision, and they were entering it into the Supernova. So I guess they just had, you know, a catalogue of songs that he had written over that few months or that year, and you know, maybe they
they didn't have that competition the way we'd have it on the Late Late Show in recent years.
Well, they did, yeah. It's actually called Supernova. So they decided
Supernova,
to enter him into, and so a few months ago in February, they went through, it's like a semi-final and a final. I think it's 15 tracks. So it went up against 15 other songs, and then it was voted, a public vote, the winner.
Well, that's a lot stronger than it's not just a national broadcaster in Latvia that picked it. It was a competition. It was a vote, and you won it.
It was a vote.
And
yeah,
you won it.
Yeah, I did. Well, Don did.
And are you a performer yourself, Liam?
I once upon a time I was. I was an artist trying to take over the world, and I think it just, you know, didn't pan out as expected, and I ended up in a more behind the scenes role, which I absolutely love. And I kind of I love it more than I loved being a performer, I think.
Okay.
So yeah, it just kind of led me into this path. So,
and have you ever entered a song into the Irish National Song Contest?
I have actually. Yeah.
Oh, have
so
you? Okay.
When I was kind of starting out, I was 17. And I entered a song called Sometimes into Eurosong, and it was the year that Dustin won. So I was one of the unlucky five that that lost to Dustin.
So you actually got to the final of the Irish National Song Contest that year.
The televised one, yeah.
Oh, well done! At 17 years of age.
I did, yeah. It was a good time. It was a rough few months in school, though. After, I'll tell you.
Well, remember, Dustin was about 40 years older than you for a start.
That's fair.
He bet you on the age stakes anyway, and the maturity stakes. The maturity stakes.
Yes.
And do you follow the Eurovision still?
I'm definitely a fan of Eurovision. Like, I kind of passively, I watch it every year and kind of, you know, listen to the few kind of top five and stuff like that. But Eurovision was kind of in the last couple of years. I went full time as a writer in 2019. So it really was, Eurovision was a big goal of mine since then, really, because it's a songwriting competition. So I've been paying more attention in recent years.
And would it mean a lot? Oh, sorry. What has it meant to you so far that you won the Latvian National Song Contest and your song is a Latvian entry?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be lovely to be flying the Irish flag in a more direct way, but having a song for Latvia is, you know, almost equally as gratifying. Like, it's a real privilege to be able to kind of fly the Irish flag in that sort of a way. And it's really just like a kind of pinnacle moment for me as a writer to just mark the occasion. And it's really the tip of the iceberg, I suppose, as a songwriter. You know, it's such an amazing competition, you know.
And if hopefully you're in there with a shout, would it mean a lot to win the Eurovision?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, no, it's an incredibly big platform and stage, and I think it would symbolically be such an amazing thing to bring home the win, but also in terms of, you know, career paths and stuff like that. It is such a major moment if you win the Eurovision. It's really, really massive, you know.
And will you go to Malmo?
Yeah. I'm heading over on the 29th of April to be there for all of the rehearsals and stuff like that. So I'll be running into the Irish team, I'm sure, hopefully, at some point.
Yeah. And they're putting an awful lot of work, as per you. And there is an incredible amount of work that goes into, because the Eurovision goes on with the semi-finals and the rehearsals. And it's a much, much bigger event than it was back in the day in terms of the resources and indeed the expertise that RT have to put in. But it's in the capable hands of was with Julian Vignoles for many, many years, brilliant, and now Michael Keeley is the man in charge. Liam, by the way, in the lyrics, did you write the lyrics of Hollow?
Yes, so I co-wrote it with the artist Dons, and Kate Northrup is our other co-writer. So we wrote it all in a studio in Spain, and then I composed the music as well and produced it out.
Well, we're talking about Waterloo, and there was obviously references to the Battle of Waterloo. Hollow, is there references to the Hollow in the Phoenix Park? Or
there isn't. Unfortunately, I'd love to say there was. Yeah, it's really just a song about in a time, I guess, where, you know, worldview wise, you know, we're as divided as we've ever been in some ways. It's really a song about kind of just following your gut and staying true to yourself. Really, and not kind of believing in anything hollow.
And what language is it in?
It's in English.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, great. Yeah. Well,
so actually, Don's released a Latvian version as well.
Okay.
So we have both versions. I didn't really participate in that process, though, as you can imagine.
Yeah. And who were the performers again?
Don's. He's a solo artist.
D-O-N-S. Okay. And the other, I'm just thinking, the only other reference to Hollow is Rosie in The Plough and the Stars, when Fluter is going on about having been battened by the DMP in the Phoenix Park, and he was showing his war wounds in the pub, and Rosie goes over to him and said, "Oh my God, look at the holler, look at the holler," referring to the bruise in his head. Okay, Liam, best of luck. Best of luck. Break a leg, Liam.
Thank you very much.
What a fantastic achievement. Well done. That's Liam Geddes. Now, where's Eddie Cummins, ex-RTE? Eddie, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
How are you?
Just listening to your show there, just brings back a lot of memories to Eurovision. I worked on the one, well, a couple of them.
We'll give you a ring back, because it sounds like you're ringing from 1974 with the bad line. We'll try and get a better line. We will in a sec. Colette Murphy. Colette, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You were listening to Colman Pearce. Tell us your memory.
Yes. This may be the first miracle ever.
Okay.
Via your good self, expert, and RTE One Radio.
Okay.
I have been thinking the last few days and wondering who was the wonderful conductor that I experienced when I was a small child.
Okay.
My parents, I remember sitting between them, brought me to a common town, and there was a concert.
Yes.
Of the songs of Percy Finch.
Ah, magic.
Very important, because my dad was from West Clare, and the West Clare Railway was important. But anyway, I have no idea, was anything staged? Was there any singing, solo, anything? My entire focus was on the most beautiful hands and the movements of that conductor. I have never forgotten it. And I'll tell you quietly and to the nation, I am now 76 years of age.
And you believe those hands were the hands of Colman Pearce?
Sorry, say that again?
You believe the hands that you were mesmerised by.
They meant something. There was something deep inside me.
Yes.
And I went to national school and we sang and all that kind of thing. And then I was very fortunate and very blessed that my parents sent me to Convent of Mercy Moat in County Westmeath.
Yeah.
Where it was there was a wonderful, wonderful choral choir teacher, Sister Claire McNamara.
Okay.
And she used to say to us, now, girls, when you have your own choirs, this is what to look for, this is what to do.
Okay.
And I would say there's a hidden talent inside in Misha was, what will I say, was brought to the fore by Sister Claire. Because I'll tell you, and I, you know, I really believe this and I watched it, people who are wonderful pianists mm-hmm. or wonderful organists are not necessarily excellent choral teachers. It's a totally different...
Okay. But you went, you became a conductor of choirs,
yes,
then, a choral conductor.
Yeah, I trained in Carisford, teacher's team, and then I went to the Mother House in Inverted Commas, the Mercy Order, and I started teaching in Bagot Street National School.
Okay.
And in a short space of time, I set up a choir.
And you now know that inspiration, when you were a child, the hands of the conductor, they were the hands, still active, thankfully, of Colman Pearce.
I believe so.
Yes, okay.
Because certainly it was not in either side of our family. And also, I could feel, when I had a choir, we say, ready for competition, that choir would do anything that I asked of them.
Okay.
No matter what the occasion was. It's like a bit of putty, more than one hand.
They were putting in your hands.
As I moved some way or the other, the girls responded with me.
You heard, Colette, have you heard the Irish entry for the Eurovision this year?
Ni Mahlame, a Chorvé.
Just let's hear a clip of listen to the Irish entry this year for the it's quite different. Colette, what do you think of that one? Apparently, it's getting good feedback.
That is not singing.
Okay.
That is not a work of art, we say, in singing.
Okay.
And my belief is that in particularly at second level, there are those who are high 600 pointers, etc. There are those who are on the school team or whatever the school is brilliant at.
Okay.
And there are brilliant debaters and everything. But the one thing where nobody needs any investment, physical, hard cash, is singing.
Exactly. Well put, and
I have girls, I remember distinctly, below on the steps of the whatever the place in Cork, the concert hall in Cork, and we had won a lovely competition, and the girls had no uniform. They were just in their ordinary clothes, whatever they gave
schooling. You're right. And any group can sing, and it doesn't cost money. Well done. Great to hear from you. That's Colette Murphy in Athlone. Eddie Cummins is back. Eddie, you worked on the 1993 Eurovision, and the crew working on the Eurovision. Did you have your favourite song?
Well, there was a song, Joe, we did the rehearsals and all that, and there was one song that stood out from all the rest. Even the press locked on to it.
Okay.
We thought this was a brilliant song. It was the Croatian song.
All right.
And the chorus was in English, and it went like, "Don't ever cry, don't ever cry, never say goodbye." And it was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Okay.
And it was tipped to do really well. Anyway, the contest was over. It finished way down the order. Way down, it was everyone was shocked, was surprised. Why did this song, it sounds so beautiful, why did it do so badly? Mm-hmm. So the next day after the show was over, I went up to the press office, and in the press office, you could get all these songs that were translated into English.
Right.
And so I went up and I got a sheet, and the English words were on it. And to my recollection, it just went, the chorus went, "Don't ever cry, don't ever cry, never say goodbye, never say goodbye. I get up in the morning and I milk the cows and I shear the sheep and I mow the lawn." It was a farmer. It was Brilliant. A farmer song. You know, and it was just so funny, and it's always stuck with me. And there was one myth I want to put to bed,
yeah.
Joe. And you know this thing where were you when Kennedy was shot?
Yes, yes.
Or where were you when Riverdance was danced?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
There was 3,500 people in that auditorium.
In Mill Street,
I worked on the 1994 one, and we knew that Riverdance was special. It was something really special. And when the show came on that night, and the late Mr. Ryan said, and then we have Riverdance.
Jerry, yeah.
And Jerry, God bless his soul.
Yeah, yeah.
I decided that I was going to go up into the gods to listen to it, to get the full, you know, because the auditorium was so big, and to get the full whack of the sound. And as I was going out backstage and up through the audience, hundreds and hundreds of people were going out to the bar. And I was going up, and they're all coming down to the bar. I said, "Look, don't go down to the bar. Go back into your seat, because you're going to really see something special. It's really special." And people just ignored me. So a lot of people there that night never actually got to see Riverdance. They might have heard it.
I know. And so, by the way, the song you're singing, the song you're referring to, Croatian entry, which you say was about farming, remember what your man, Nicholas Witchell, the royal correspondent of BBC, he described Mill Street as a glorified cowshed. Which was of course great upset, because it was magnificently staged by RTE.
Show, yeah.
And the song, the winning song, was "In Your Eyes" by Niamh Kavanagh.
Yeah, Niamh Kavanagh.
Yeah,
yeah,
great. Yeah. Well, we did well.
But there's one thing if I have the time, Joe.
Yeah, no.
It's to do with Riverdance, Joe, and something that the public wouldn't know about is at the opening of that song, when Jean Butler came out and she had this cloak. And she sped away and the cloak fell on the ground. That wasn't supposed to happen. It was supposed to fly out, but they couldn't get the mechanism to work for it to fly out up into the gods. But there was one other thing that was really remarkable about that dance, and that was what's his name? The guy that danced this.
Michael Flatley.
Yeah, keep forgetting his name.
Yeah.
Remarkable, Joe, because when they came out to do the first rehearsal, and we did about 5 rehearsals of that dance, it was every time they did it, it was remarkable. There was one remarkable thing about it was that stage area was like 80 by 40. It was an enormous big stage area. And when that drum started and he came out and he went din, 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 and he went right across the stage. He jumped in the air, crossed his feet and crossed and tapped one toe on the ground. This was across like an 80-foot stage. And after the fifth rehearsal, the painter came to me, and God rest his soul, Andy Hersey, I think, was the painter.
Yeah.
He said, "Ed, come over here, I want to show you something." And in those 5 rehearsals across that stage, he hit the same mark within 2 inches. Because Andy was saying to me, "Look, I had to put this little 2-inch square of tape, because it was a contact floor, and if you kind of hit it too hard, it would scuff, you know, mark, would tear." And so that guy was so remarkably accurate that on those 5 rehearsals, when he came out and danced across the floor, jumped up in the air, did a twirl, and tapped one foot on the ground, he hit the same mark within 2 inches.
Brilliant.
He was just a perfectionist.
That's a pro, yeah, that's a pro. Eddie, great to hear you. That's Eddie Cummins, ex-RTE, and one of the great public servants that are behind the scenes, but keep this place going, make this place what it is, in fact, over many, many years. God bless you, Eddie. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Okay, sticking with music, a couple of months ago, and I hear all the ads back on again for different concerts. So, and I presume people will read the small print, but a couple of months ago we got actually it's nearly going back a year to say, we got calls from people saying that they attended a Forever Young concert, which was down off the Nace Road there, and the second day was a complete washout and they weren't allowed in, and they tried to get their money back, and we had the organiser on and she said they would get their money back. It's now into April, as I say, nearly a year later. Dave, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Did you get your money back?
No.
How much?
€480.
I forgot. But we were promised on this program that you would get your money back.
Yeah, the 9th of January I spoke to you.
No words.
No. An email last week.
Good luck.
About a crowdfunding and a GoFundMe page. That's all.
But we were told by the organiser at the time she was waiting on a VAT rebate or something.
Absolutely. That's the only correspondence since the 9th of January.
And he's still going to... And there's a lot of people owed money, apparently.
Yeah. Was the figure mentioned at the last programme, Joe? Did you mention a figure of the total, what was owed?
No, I don't. I can't
remember.
You
did. Yeah. Okay. Now, one of York sister consumer affairs programme started up a few weeks ago. One lady complained about it, and she was paid €300. I watched it.
Okay.
And the lady that ran the Forever Young appeared on the programme.
Very good.
But it was one individual got paid. That's the only correspondence I've seen on television or anything about that concert last year.
And did the programme mention that a lot of people hadn't been repaid?
Well, I... Not 100%.
That was very good of her. She got her television exposure and she refunded one person. That gives us a break.
One lady.
Stay there, Dave. Stephen Brennan. Stephen.
Hi, how's it going, Joe?
How much are you owed?
€160.
Okay. But you were... So
I was actually one of the musicians from the festival. I was playing on the second stage on Saturday and Sunday. And we got 50% of what we were promised, our whole band. So.
Oh, you didn't get paid your full fee?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So we kind of went into it having an idea of what we were going to get paid, and then we got half of it, and we haven't seen the rest of it yet, so...
Oh, for God's sake. And a band, like, you're called Rockstar Karaoke.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, that's it.
But you're not living in the lap of luxury from your earnings from a band.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So I'm lucky enough to have like a 9-to-5 as well.
But
some of the guys in the band would be full-time musicians, so they would be depending on the money from this festival and some other gigs like it. So to the point where they would be turning down other gigs to play festivals like this. So.
Of course. Are you optimistic?
No, I'm not. I put a post up on Facebook in December after she blocked our agent, and then the festival blocked us on social media, so we don't even know what they're posting about anymore.
Okay, once again, let the word go out to Forever Young Festival. People want their money back. They deserve their money back. You got their money. You got their money. You got good money, and you got it nearly a year ago, and people want their money back, please. And by looking at our screen here, you're going to have to... If you give back... if you refund one person when you get a slot on the television programme for the publicity that you get... We're going to need a few hundred television programmes before we get everyone refunded, such as the number of people who feel badly done by. Thanks, Stephen, and thanks, Dave. Stephen Brennan and Dave. Jackie Howard contacted us. Jackie, what happened? This is a bizarre one. Tell us.
Hi, Joe. Thanks a million for taking the call. Saturday the 23rd of March, I brought my aunt, elderly aunt, to 44 Westland Row to the Church of St. Andrews for what was supposed to be a candlelight concert at 6:30, featuring the best of Joe Hisaishi, a violinist, I believe. I'm not sure.
And it was St. Andrews is a beautiful, beautiful church in Westland Row in Dublin, and it's been nominated as the new pro-cathedral, so to speak. Now, I don't know how far advanced we are. They want, the church want to move the pro-cathedral, the designature of it, so to speak, from Marlborough Street, the church, St. Mary's there, over to St. Andrews, because it's a much bigger venue. So, you bought tickets for a
concert? No, my cousin, Ruth, she bought her mother her Mother's Day tickets.
Okay.
But she lives in Galway.
Mother's Day, okay.
I'm here in Meath, and I said I'll pick her up and bring her.
Okay.
Which I did.
Yes.
And so I left here about 4:15 to go pick her up at 5:15.
Yeah.
So that we'd be in town.
Yes.
On time.
Yes.
Seated out of respect for the performers.
Of course.
So when I arrived at St. Andrews, there was a crowd. I'd say an estimated about 30 people.
Okay.
And so I passed through the crowd, and as I got up to the two ladies at the gate, now I pushed through because it was freezing cold.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrible wind, and my aunt was, as I said, she's elderly, and we had walked a fair distance to get there, you know. So I heard some disgruntled conversation, but couldn't make out.
Okay.
So I proceeded to navigate my aunt through the crowd and into the church.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got in, just got to the gate, two young ladies in fever t-shirts said to me, sorry, the concert is cancelled.
Yeah.
It's not fever's fault. It's the church's fault. They failed to notify fever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe that. So I pushed on into the church to see if someone could corroborate or verify the story.
Yeah.
And when I went in, the church was practically empty. It was empty. It was about eight very senior ladies and gentlemen who appeared to be waiting for something, but I don't think it was a concert. But when I got in anyway, I could see that the church has been prepared for Mass. Okay?
Yeah.
Bowls of palm are coming out, etc., etc.
For Palm Sunday, you know? The next day, yeah.
For Palm Sunday, the next day. So, in the heat of the hunt, all I can see to you is we arrived for what was supposed to be the best of Joe Hisaishi.
Yeah.
Tickets were bought, and we were told it was cancelled on the basis that the church failed to inform the event managers.
But the church contests that. My understanding is the church says, should we have Mass there every Saturday at that time?
Absolutely. It's on their website, Joe.
Yes.
It's now, on
Fever,
their website.
Fever are the organised, and people will see they're advertising heavily, but online anyway, these candlelit concerts around, get in out of the stress of busy cities and come in to these candlelit concerts in various venues around Dublin. I've seen them so far. I don't know, maybe there's 8, 9, 10 musicians, and the place is, I don't know if it's real candles or battery operated candles, but there's the photographs give the impression that they're real candles, and it looks like a very tranquil, serene location. Did you get your money back, by the way?
No. Now, see, I'm not the person who bought
the
ticket.
I know that. But the tickets, by the way, the tickets aren't cheap.
No, not by any means.
Yeah.
Not by any means. I called my cousin and I said, listen, just to let you know, we didn't get to a concert and you need to deal with that. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she did. So in the heat of the hunt, she informed me that she received an email at 7:08. Now, she wasn't aware of this email because she thought we were at the concert and she was all about her business, you know. So it was only later in the evening when we got home that I had this conversation with her. But I would reckon, and I'm saying this, I made it so clear to everybody outside who were coming for that concert that there was no concert planned. There never was going to be a concert planned because there was Mass.
Yeah.
And I said, I too have tickets. I want you to know that, you know. Now, people were disgusted. And
but
I just can't...
But could they not have contacted you by email? Or even if
no, they
was?
Can't... This is the point. I don't think... I think the only email that they got, that Ruth got, my cousin, was at, as I said, 7:08. I reckon that was because I made such a fuss outside. I don't think she would have ever received it. I can't say that for sure, but that's what happened. But no, there was, if they knew, I'd like to ask the question of Fever, if they knew there was no concert, why did they not cancel it earlier in the day? You know, why didn't they contact people? You know, and if, do you know what I mean? They talk about on their website that they have these teams expert to contact scientists and local community people who feed them information about what's available in terms of venues. Yeah.
Yeah.
How come they never went on to the church website and see that there is a mass there every Saturday night at 6:30?
Okay.
There is no way anybody who has tickets should have been sold tickets.
Okay, and they're on, but it's called Concert by Candlelight. They're on various venues. The tickets are, I'm looking at one venue this weekend, it's £40 at the tickets that I left. And you still haven't got your money back?
No.
Okay.
What it says here is city specialists and data-driven content. Fever city specialists collaborate with data scientists to curate the most demanded and exciting events.
Yeah, and they're in hundreds of cities around the world. This whole candidate idea. Okay,
they're
Jackie.
As
they say in all the best newspapers, we've reached out to Fever, but they haven't reached back. And they're very good at communicating and advertising, but they're not very good at speaking on the radio. Apparently, they're a bit shy. But anyway, we'd read out any statement in great detail and with my best voice, should it come in. But that's what happened. You and you're still waiting, and your family and your mother-in-law, and you're still waiting on your money back. Okay, go to Míle Maga, Jackie Howard, back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Michael Lynch, back to Eurovision briefly. You've interviewed all seven winners. Go ahead, Michael. How did you organise all seven Irish winners?
Yes, I did, Joe, for a book about 8 years ago. And not just the winners. I wanted to tell the story of the people that haven't won it as well. They had a more interesting story, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Tina Tully or Tina Reynolds that we mentioned, who sang the Irish entry under the baton of Colman Pearce in 74, is living, thankfully, and alive and well, living in the Midlands in Ireland, which is great.
Brilliant, yeah.
And it's up there on YouTube. It was a magnificent performance by Tina on the day. So you've
could I just say, Joe, the writer of that song, the late Paul Little, who used to be in Chips.
I
interviewed Paul as well. Lovely man, and that's, as we said, 50 years ago tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay. Well remembered. Now you say you point. There's a number of fun facts. For example, the legendary Phil Coulter. He wrote the winning entry for the UK.
Yeah, you were talking to Liam there, and I was delighted he's going to get the opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think people do forget that people like Phil Coulter would have, back in the day when he was writing songs in the UK, he wrote Poppin' on a String in 67 and won it for the UK. And then the following year, he wrote Congratulations for Cliff Richard and almost won it again. So, and then he wrote for Luxembourg in 75 for his now wife Geraldine. So he had a pedigree, and he produced, as we know, he produced kind of all kinds of everything at the time. So he was heavily involved and a lovely man, great songwriter. And I think he told me at the time when I interviewed him for the book, he at the time was never really asked by RTE to write a song for them. So sometimes they tend to overlook their own, which is a bit unfortunate. Yeah.
Okay. And Michael, what's happened to us in the last? Well, sorry, what's happened to competition in the last few years? Not us. Our standard has been good. What's happened to competition in the last few years that it looks like we're almost written off before we get there? I know Jedward did well.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't agree with you that I don't think it's just. I think our standard has dropped, but Michael Healy can only submit whatever songs he receives, to be fair to the guy.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a poison chalice, and people are afraid of it now. Back in the day, the 80s, 90s, it was won by real good songs, especially stuff like, the 60s, 70s, even if they didn't win, some fantastic stuff going back to, If I Could Choose from Sean Dunphy back in the day, and Rolling Sobers, Come Back to Stay for Dickie, like that.
Yeah,
brilliant
yeah.
songs. But nowadays, obviously it's a different era, different audience voting for them. So I think it's not a song contest anymore. It's more the visual side of it.
Okay.
And, people will tick the boxes of, we'll say, gender or LGBT and stuff like that. But the song part of it seems to be gone now, and okay. I wouldn't hold much hope for her own entry this year now. That's my own opinion.
Okay, and have you heard many of the entries this year?
No, I haven't. Okay. I'll hear them over the next couple of weeks now. I usually wait till about a week or two beforehand and listen to them.
It's at the end of the month, and it's in Malmö in Sweden, and best of luck to Bambi Tug. I hope they do well. Thanks indeed, Michael. That's Michael Lynch. Well, go ahead. 6th of April, 1974, 50 years ago. What happened, Joe?
Hello, Joe. How you doing? 6th of April, 1974, ABBA won the Eurovision.
Yes.
19 years of age, I walked into the cricket club in Clontarf, and there was a young Mabel Sly, and we've been together ever since. Isn't that lovely?
What was her name again? Mabel, like my own mother, like a good friend of mine as well. Mabel, yeah. Gorgeous name.
Mabel Sly, S-L-Y-E. Yeah.
And soon after that, were you married, Joseph?
3 years later, Joe.
Okay. And did you play Waterloo at the wedding?
No, I can't remember what we played.
Well, ABBA may have won the Eurovision that night, but you won the Euro Lotto, Joe. Well done when you met Mabel,
Joe,
in the cricket club. And she's still with us, I hope, and good health to the two of you and
she's
your family.
Still there, yeah. Yeah, great. Three kids, two young grandchildren.
Brilliant.
Lately. All good.
Brilliant. Well
all
done.
Good.
That's Joe Bourne in Raheny. Joe and Mabel, broadcast coordinator. And good luck, by the way, to Bambi Thug. They look and sound fantastic. Shane Galvin is the BCO. Research, Richie Byrne, series producer Annette Egan, and Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.